listening to the premiere broadcast of Goat Song Radio, where we endeavor to A, hasten the demise of terrestrial radio, B, bring you things you should know about, and C, counter mediocrity in general. Accordingly, it's only fitting that our first broadcast focus on the new book, Sweat, The Story of the Fleshtones, America's Garage Band, written by my good friend Joe Bonomo and published by Continuum, 2007. Peter Buck of REM said of Sweat, "This great book by Joe Bonomo really gets to the heart of who the Fleshtones are. Now it's up to you to check out the Fleshtones when they hit your town." So enough of my tomfoolery, and onward to Sweat, the story of America's garage band, the Fleshtones.
Well, come on! Hey,
could I be wrong?
Well, come on!
Ooh, coming on too strong.
Well, come on!
Well, mess at me.
Everyone can see that you're coming on to me. I'm gonna tell your girlfriend,
yeah, yeah,
and your boyfriends too.
Go ahead and get started.
All right.
I'll go ahead and ask the really stupid questions first, get those out of the way.
Yeah.
So who are the Fleshtones, and why did you write a book about them?
The Fleshtones are a great garage rock and roll band out of New York. They've been together since 1976. They are, in fact, the only band that debuted, in their case, at CBGB's in 1976 that's still together without a single inactive year. And they've been located in Brooklyn now. They were kind of scattered around Manhattan for a while. They're all in Brooklyn. And they're a great rock and roll band that's been sort of under the radar for decades now. And sometime, I've been a fan since 83, basically, when I first saw them in Washington, D.C. And sometime about 10 years ago, it occurred to me what a cool story they are. And what a, you know, because I knew they were a bunch of fun New York through and through borough guys and that they led a pretty wild road life. And I knew they had funny stories and they're funny guys. And I figured that the road stories alone would make a great book. So I pitched it to them one night, actually, at the Union in Athens, Ohio, when they were playing, and they thought it was a great idea. They didn't ever think I'd get the thing done or published, but they thought it was a good idea, and they were on board from the beginning. And then the more I started writing it and researching it, and I would move up to New York City for a month at a time every summer from 2000 to 2004, it occurred to me that they really have become sort of an invisible band in terms of critics. Because they were never mentioned anywhere in any of the sort of celebrated famous books about the punk scene in the mid-70s, Please Kill Me, and the book about CBGBs, and book about Max's Kansas City. You never heard the mention of the Fleshtones anywhere, and I thought that was, first of all, inaccurate, and second of all, really unfair. And so the book kind of took on a different momentum when I thought I'm going to sort of rewrite history here, you know, kind of rescue this invisible band, and that's what I did. Part of the problem, too, is that when the Fleshtones debuted, it was like on the cusp of sort of indie rock becoming established and permanent. And so what happened is there was an explosion of bands. There were just so many more bands playing out in the late 70s and the early 80s than there were, you know, even 5 years before they started. So there were just, there was so much more competition, first of all. So it was easier for a band to be sort of ignored or to fly under the radar. And the thing that both hurt, but ultimately I think saved and redeemed the Fleshtones, is that they really never sold records.
Yeah.
You know, because if they had made it big, for example, like the B-52s, or even a band like the Ramones or the Cramps, they would be sort of frozen in time, you know, whatever year, let's guess 1984, that they had this imaginary massive hit. Man, they'd be, you know, required to, like, play that at every show, and they'd be become this sort of 80s band, and they really would be celebrated, maybe, but they'd be sort of trapped in time. And I think the good thing about the Fleshtones is they never became huge or famous, and they never had to sort of compromise. So that's one, I think, reason why they remained under the radar. But I also think that for people, the Fleshtones were kind of hard. They were both easy to dismiss and hard to categorize.
Yeah.
That was something that allowed them, unfortunately, for their sake, to fall through the cracks, at least commercially. And, you know, people don't want to work to figure something out. They either want to like it or be told by the major labels that they like it or they don't.
Did working with IRS hurt them in the sense that might it have looked to, you know, some that they tried to sell out but couldn't find a buyer?
That's a good question. I could actually speak from experience because I became a fan of the band when they were on IRS. I first saw them in 83 right after Hexbreaker came out, which was arguably one of their best records and was, you know, their best shot at least on that label for success. And I never got the feeling that they were selling out because you could just one spin of that record and you knew how different they were from other bands, even other bands on the same label, you know, on the same roster. They never had that sort of, I remember even noticing this in 1984 or 3, that they never had that sort of synthesizer sheen that so many popular bands sort of needed to have in order to get on mainstream radio.
Right.
So I don't think that they were looked at as selling out at IRS. People who really knew the band, who dug them and saw them live and knew their songs, knew that they were being, that is, the Fleshtones were being uncompromising on IRS.
Yeah.
That's what hurt them more than anything else.
Yeah.
They were never going to change their sound for mainstream acceptance.
Talk about on page 74, sort of juxtaposing the Fleshtones against, you know, other bands that were sort of catching on during that time, and with, you know, all the scene at CBGBs and so on and so forth. They failed to become scenesters. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was sort of the problem, you know, problem in quotation marks. The Fleshtones were never quite hip enough to be sort of scene regulars in the way that, say, Richie Hell was, or the Ramones were, or the later day version of the New York Dolls, or even Bowie and Iggy Pop, you know, on the Maxis scene. In part because these Fleshtones, they were from the boroughs, you know, they were from Queens, which is like the equivalent of not the suburbs really, but, you know, they were from the far flung boroughs, and Manhattan to them was still an intimidating place in some regard. And so they didn't quite hang out on the scene the way the real sort of decadent, you know, Mink DeVille, Patti Smith sort of crowd was glomming onto the scene in order to be seen. They weren't really into that. I mean, they hung out. They played these places, and they hung out in the bars and everything, but, I don't know, they weren't sleeping with the right people, they weren't doing drugs with the right people, you know, and they just, by accident and by design, they never quite became hip and trendy on the scene. And that might have hurt them at the time, but as Andy Chernoff says later on in the book, Andy Chernoff from The Dictator says, how many of those people are together making music anymore, you know?
Right. And the thing is, too, to me, what is remarkable about the Fleshtones is that they flirt with various things, you know, in terms of, for lack of better words, we'll say this, retro, right?
Yeah, sure.
But they're not essentially retro. That's not their shtick.
Nope.
I mean, they're now. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
That might be the way they filter it. That might be the way they accent it. But there now.
This is something that I sensed in the Fleshtones from the very beginning, when I first saw them in the early 80s. It's just something I intuitively got right away, and lots of other people did. They weren't a retro band. They were playing rock and roll. That's all.
Right.
A retro band was Stray Cats.
Yeah.
And Brian Setzer is a great guitar player, and he wrote a lot of fun songs, but they were actively courting the look and the gear and the shtick, and that became sort of prominent.
Yeah.
And Zarembas, in the book, sort of speaks of that. He says that, you know what, in the 60s, I was an unhappy kid. The last thing I want to do is recreate the 60s.
Right.
You know, I'm playing rock and roll. That matters to me now as a guy in my 20s, 30s, 40s, and now 50s, you know.
It amazes me, you know, I kept reading this, and it was like, you know, these guys are, you know, they start out as kind of regular guys, blue-collar guys, right?
Yeah.
And most people that, you know, join a band or start a band or are serious about it are, and I think it sort of is something that's not unique to one genre of music. And then something happens, I don't know, you know, through the process of trying to just make music and have a good time and spread, you know, cheer and have people sort of join in and, you know, partake in the fun, you experience the worst that humanity has to offer, and you meet the shadiest people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's amazing to me, you know.
It is amazing, isn't it?
And it's like the stories of, and like this whole thing about the practice space with I have it marked down here in terms of what page it's on.
How about Billy Ball?
The guys became accustomed to Piano's reckless behavior and to his hangers-on. But the most bizarre element in his world wasn't the drug abuse or the dealing or the deconstructionist organ playing. It was Igor, a young man named Chris, who Piano kept underground
as his low-rent slave, whom he would literally lock in the basement overnight to guard equipment. Billy controlled Chris by supplying him with dope, says Merrick. He lived in the basement like the watchdog. Chris would let us in, and his hands were like softball mitts because he'd been shooting up in them.
Yeah, that was interesting. They had the Fleshtones, as soon as they moved sort of into Manhattan from Queens, they needed a rehearsal space, so they found this rehearsal space that this guy named Billy Ball's Piano was renting out in his basement off of St. Mark's Place on 8th Avenue. And this guy, nobody really knew what he did. He had a big white grand piano in the front window of the store at street level that was gathering dust. Nobody really knew what he did except that he was very, very infamous as the best dope dealer in the East Village, especially in the St. Mark's Place sort of area. And the Fleshtones was happily rented there because it was a good space, but it was in the basement. And as Zaremba talks about in the book, this was a place in New York that, you know, centuries ago had been all swamp, and it was just like hell down there. You know, it was damp and earthen, and the place just bred thousands of mosquitoes that they had to literally protect themselves from by aiming fans in their direction. I mean, it was really just a kind of a gross place. And worse than that, this guy Billy had basically a slave that he kept down in the basement, and he was chained on him, and he was ostensibly the night watchman for the place. But this guy Billy would chain him in. His guy's name was Chris, and he was his dope dealer, and there was a real terrible codependent relationship going on, and all sorts of tawdry, horrible stuff went on down in that basement.
And it's just
that
amazing.
Was the Fleshtones just formed, and men of lesser stock, maybe of different sensitivities, would have been so turned off and kind of scarred by that. But the Fleshtones have seen so much in their career; they're jaded now.
I don't understand. I mean, vice cops don't see stuff like that, you know?
Yeah,
but
strange.
You play in a rock band, you see stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And like you say, it becomes part of the territory.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Gandhi said that first they ignore you, then they make fun of you, then they attack you, and then you win.
That's a great quote.
So it seems like to me the Fleshtones have been ignored, been made fun of, been attacked, and then they're going to win. Nope, they don't win. They go back to being ignored, being made fun of, attacked, but never the winning point. So, you know, it comes back to a very simple but a very complex notion, which is, you know, it's about the music, right?
Exactly, right. It is about the music, but also I would say that it's about how one defines winning. You know, because if one defines winning in this context as meaning you finally get the million-selling record, finally get, you know, what we used to say on MTV, I don't even know if that's really a cachet anymore. You know, you finally get on the Billboard charts, you play on Leno, et cetera, et cetera. You get these worldwide tours. If that's how you define winning, then yes, the Fleshtones are always falling short of that. But if you define winning in a different way, I don't mean in an abnormal way even, but maybe in an unconventional way, then you could see the Fleshtones are actually a very successful band.
Are you feeling good? Say yeah!
Yeah.
Are you feeling ready? Say yeah!
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 Yeah! Yeah.
Joe Bonomo teaches in the English department at Northern Illinois University. His personal essays and prose poems appear widely. He first saw the Fleshtones play at the legendary 930 Club in Washington, D.C. in 1983. He currently lives in Illinois. His book can be purchased at Amazon.com. Please visit Joe at myspace.com/FleshtonesSweat. The Fleshtones' new album is Take a Good Look and is available on Yep Rock Records. Stay tuned and check myspace.com/HansFrank for details about part two of the Sweat podcast. Until then, peace, love, and analog.